This is episode number 97 with digital e-commerce specialist Nick Pape.
Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today I've got an exciting episode with an interesting guest, Nicholas Pape. He used to live in the UK, now he's back in Australia. And he's an e-commerce specialist. So first things first, this episode is available in video format. So head on over to www.superdatascience.com/97 if you're in front of your computer, and you can watch it there on video. And in today's episode, you will find out a lot of insights into the world of e-commerce and retail, selling retail products online. So Nicholas has about 20 years of experience in the space of e-commerce. And now his strategy about data science is to learn data science, to use data science techniques in the space of e-commerce. It's really interesting. So he's not necessarily looking to become a full-time data scientist, even though that might happen as well. But his main focus is to borrow those most important, most powerful methodologies to bring into his domain. So this episode could be very interesting for those of you who are in similar situations. And in this episode, we'll talk about e-commerce, CMS, or customer management systems, geodemographic segmentation. We'll discuss some interesting insights about purchasing habits of people, such as looking at emails on Friday, purchasing on Sunday on eBay, or why purchases drop off in retail, usually in February. And we'll talk about seasonality. We'll talk about customer experience. So lots and lots of interesting topics that we're going to discuss, and I think this episode is important because it helps put a face to a name, so to speak, in data science. A lot of the time we're working with data, but we don't think about the customers who are behind that data. This episode will help you keep in touch with what's actually going on and better understand what the customers are going through in this whole process. And without further ado, I bring to you Nick Pape. Welcome, everybody, to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today, I've got a very exciting and fun and interesting guest, my friend from England, actually from Australia, but it lives in England, Nick Pape. Nick, how are you going, man?
Good, Kirill. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. So, it's been a while, right, since we met?
Yeah, about a month and a half. Yeah, literally.
Yeah, only. We were, for those who don't know, we were traveling on a trip with Adlan, like Eurotrip, and we're having catch-ups, and Nick was at our catch-up in London, and dude, we had like the best time. Like you were sitting next to me during dinner, we just chatting away all night long, right?
Good. Yeah, it got pretty deep fast. It was good. It's good banter.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So I really appreciate meeting an Aussie. How did you get to England? What are you doing there, man?
So I came over about 8 years ago to get a digital education, basically. Mm. Got sponsored, had a great role, and thought, yep, UK is where it's at to learn digital and e-commerce. Yeah. And that's what I've been doing for about 8 years, yeah.
Yeah, and how's the weather?
Stereotypically true.
Yeah. We were there, first day was so sunny and nice. I was like, all these rumors about London, they're not true, this is amazing. And then for the remaining 2 or 3 days we were there, like it rained 5 times per day. It was crazy, man, out of nowhere.
You get every season in one day. Yeah, even in summer.
Yeah. So the question is, why does somebody trade the sunshine of 364 days per year in Australia for what you get in London? Why would you do this to yourself?
I think I've been asked that question every day that I've lived here. Yeah, no easy answer. I think it's because you want to get out of, you actually come over here to get out of here to get to Europe so quickly.
Okay. Yeah. True. It's very, it's like you can get to Europe like 2 hour flight, right? Anywhere in Europe, maximum.
Yeah. You go get to Amsterdam in 40 minutes if you want to go to The Hague. So that's pretty cool.
That's crazy.
Can't do that in Australia.
Yeah. And like, a lot of time people would say, oh, you guys are going, you know, like you're in London, but you're going to like Prague or something and it's so far away. No, it's not. It's like 2 hours
away.
No,
it's not. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, when you visit Australia, you start talking to your friends and they say, oh yeah, where'd you travel? And they say, oh yeah, we went camping here. And they said, oh, where'd you travel, Nick? And you're just like, oh, well, you know, been to Italy this week, France that week, Spain that week. So, and then you just look like an idiot.
yeah, totally. All right, data science, right? So wondering like what are we like these two idiots chatting about here? We want to talk about data science, right? So you tell us about your story. Like you are in CRM, is that correct?
Yeah, that's it. So so newly into the world of CRM. So it's all about looking at data and the insights from the data to then make action on that data, largely to help a customer achieve a goal or find new customers or reactivate customers. So it's really interesting.
And CRM stands for customer relationship management, right?
Gotcha.
Okay. And so you're looking to get into the space of data science or, you know, you want to acquire some skills from data science to apply in your CRM role?
Yeah, it's the latter. So definitely get skills. So my job, whilst it's a CRM role, is largely e-commerce, right? So it's not just about learning about the customer journey and the life cycles of the customer, but it's also doing everything else, you know, what channels we look at to get more of those customers.
Yeah.
And so in order to do that, you know, things like Excel only get you so far. So I've had to quickly upskill to start delving into how I start analyzing that data quite quickly. And then now it's just by pure osmosis, and I dare say your courses, it helps me, you know, I'm starting to explore this potential data science arena, which is a very new world.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. And so how's it going? Like, what about the tools or what have you picked up so far that you'd say is the most valuable for your CRM role?
Yeah, so I came in with just really good Excel, Power BI experience and then quickly learned SQL. And then somebody said, hey, have you ever heard of Tableau? And I said, no. And then within about 72 hours, I was like, this is the best thing since sliced bread.
Since what? Sliced bread.
Sliced bread, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And then I took, coincidentally, I'm not plugging you too much here, but I took one of your courses and I went, right, this is actually quite easy. It was a bit like duck to water. And by the end of the week, I was doing all these visualizations and taking people on this journey about what our customer was doing.
So you were actually using Tableau at work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got a license, just got one of those trial licenses and then uploaded some data. And then it was awesome. It just, completely redefined the way that I was talking about what was happening with the customer. And I was actually able to visualize it quite quickly. So, within a week, I turned around some pretty cool skills and bought a lot of my stakeholders along for the journey as well.
I learned an interesting term from a friend about, I think, a year and a half ago about this. It's called threshold concept. It's like once you learn something, you never look at the world the same again. Like now that you know how easy it is to create those dashboards and use Tableau, you're never going to look at a problem in the same way. You're never going to go like, you know, or like, how do I apply Excel or anything? You're always going to know, wow, it can be solved so easily with Tableau. That's how I would characterize learning Tableau and, pretty much any data science, but especially Tableau because it's so powerful and you can learn it so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I used to play with, you know, like paid search, like Google AdWords, right? I used to like look at that data in Excel and my computer would just churn and churn. And churn, and then with Tableau, you just upload this like flat data, and then within, like a text file, and then within about 2 seconds, you've got it's already rendered all the data, and you've got all this insight, and you're like, it's made everything very productive quite quickly. So it's quite cool.
Yeah, fantastic. And so you're moving back to Australia now, right?
Yeah, wrapping up the experience and going back to a market that's growing quite quickly in e-commerce, but it's obviously quite a smaller country compared to the UK. Hoping to capitalize on that and then, go forward with this learning and seeing if, data science is going to be a new feather in my bow. Because I'm not a typical, I'm not an analyst. I'm not a mathematician, right? So it's quite a new world because when you start looking at data science and whatnot, typically that's the benchmark a lot of people I've observed come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think there's a big path there for people that work in digital or e-commerce roles. You need to have this data-driven insight. Otherwise, it's just subjective thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good skill that I think everybody needs to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha. And so you're going back to Australia, are you still with the same company or you found yourself a new role? What's the go there?
Yeah, I'm looking at a new role because the company I'm leaving is largely a UK business. You know, they're a global footwear brand, but they're hubs in the UK. But there's a massive opportunity in Australia. There's a lot of other brands there that I'm sure can benefit from the experience.
That's really cool. And so do you think, like you did mention that you're kind of like going to explore, but what's your gut feel? Are you going to, jump into data science at some point, or are you going to like slowly get the feel for it? What's going on there?
I think, you know what, I've been listening to a few of the podcasts and from our chat, and I think I've got to put, some time into like Upwork or like one of those, ad hoc sort of consultancy just to see whether I can, there's proof in the pudding here, because when you're doing things remotely, it might not work as well, but definitely want to explore it and maybe go down a consulting path or.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's a good approach. Use Upwork to see if there's proof in the pudding and to put a feather in your hat.
Cap. I'll try and scale back on my.
No. It's the best thing since sliced bread, man. This is so cool.
Just for everybody out here, you were loving all of these when we went to dinner, right?
Yeah. I was like, where are you coming up with this stuff, bro? Like, I don't know, is this Australian or is this British? Where are they coming from?
It's hybrid, mate.
It's a hybrid. Yeah. Nick was telling me before the podcast that, there's Aussies here, there's British people here, and Nick is somewhere here in between. He's got a world of his own. So yeah.
Yeah, just like you, mate.
I guess so. Yeah.
I think just a bit more straight and narrow.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So cool. So you're going back to Oz. I like that concept that, a lot of people use Upwork to start into freelancing, to become consultants, but why not? Why not use Upwork not to become a freelancer or consultant, but to, test out if there's demand for these skills? Maybe then you will become a freelancer, or maybe then you'll just go venture more into data science in a corporate role or in an industry role. So it's a good idea. I've never thought of that, of Upwork that way.
Yeah, because I think, you got to validate what you're learning in some way, right? And if you can't do that in your day-to-day job, mm-hmm. you got to find other avenues to do it. And there's obviously a market out there, but how do you market yourself mm-hmm. or your skill set for what you do? So it's interesting because a lot of the analysts and data people I've worked with in my jobs in e-com, typically they're completely, they're ostracized from the rest of the business because, all they do is look at data. But I think you'll find they're going to be the gold dust. They're going to be the people that transform a business quite quickly because they're the ones that know how to actually bring people along the journey and what's happening with their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can just distill that skill and take it and put on something like Upwork, good could happen quite quickly.
Yeah, for sure. And so what are your thoughts on general like data science? Like you mentioned that more and more businesses need to be data driven, and even the CRM skills or CRM work that you're performing needs to be powered by data. This is just like your opinion on your gut feel on what you need to be doing. Like what are your thoughts on data science in general in the world? How's it developing from your perspective?
I think, it's a very, very broad question. I think people need to be people that are in, especially in e-com role, need to be quite aware of it, because the way we make decisions now is not as linear as I think we all thought it was 20 years ago, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I want to buy something, so I will go buy it. Now it's, I'll look at 50 different sources on my phone and multiple devices. There's so much data happening mm-hmm. with how you purchase now that it's not as simple as just saying, I have a product, let's buy it. So I think, yeah, again, I'm talking in the context of e-com businesses or people selling product, but anybody in any e-com role needs to really think about data and how that's going to drive and what that's actually telling you, because my role is all about, you know, who's going to buy next, you know, when will I see them again? So you've got, there is a science behind it, right? But it just depends on businesses and how they'll get their staff to learn about potential data science techniques, or they just get a team in and they do it all for them. So it's definitely a hot topic, right? Especially in our arena, it's a very hot topic, but people, I don't think, really understand what data science is, and it's just too mathematical. But if you look at in the UK, it's about what customers are going to do and propensity modeling and attribution and all of those types of concepts are very hot topics, and people always talk about it, but I don't think they actually know much about it. So there's a huge opportunity there for people like yourself to say, actually, it's not as hard as everybody thinks, because there's so many support tools out there to help make actionable insight from data. You don't actually have to be a statistician or a mathematician to do this. It's actually quite easy to do. But I think, in my subjective opinion, a lot of people just look at things like Excel and they're like, yeah, that's how you do data science.
Yeah. No, that's not. That's not how you do data science most of the time. And that's good. That means there's opportunity to improve or opportunity to add more value just by using different tools or exploring opportunities, exploring ways to use those tools. I'm suggesting.
Yeah. If you're somebody just getting into the field, or again, I know I'm being very weighted towards e-com here, but if you've just come out of university, for example, or you want to get into an e-com role, typically they don't ask for a lot of these skill sets, but I can guarantee you that if you can create influence through actionable data insight in your business, it's a massive skill that businesses will just eat up versus just saying, oh, you know, do you know how to use Microsoft Excel and Word and whatnot? It's somebody throwing you a data set and you giving them insight from it quite quickly is going to be a very valuable skill moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, totally agree. And tell us more about e-commerce. So like you said that like you use data science or like data science techniques in the space of e-commerce. Like, can you give us an example of like how you've taken e-commerce data and like some modeling or whatever you did with it that helped get a good result in that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the simplest way to sort of explain this is, you know, you have say 100 customers and typically any e-commerce wants to know how many of those 100 customers will we see next year? Mm-hmm. So if you purchase something, say in Black Friday, when will I see you again? And understanding that data and the sort of trends of that. So if you want to say cluster that, I don't want to get too deep, but typically X percent of, you know, maybe 20 or 30% of your customers will return the next year. Mm-hmm. And you need to understand why that is, what's influencing them, what's influencing such a small number of customers to come back. And that's a great starting point, because you can understand, well, how can I get more of those customers back? Because it's going to be a lot cheaper to reactivate those customers than it is to find new ones. But typically in e-commerce roles, it's all about finding you know, as many customers as possible, and typically they're new customers. So you're going to take your customer on a journey. So in what I've done, it's pivotal that you understand why your customers don't come back, how you get new customers, and essentially look at the dates in between. You know, do they come back a year on the dot, or do they come back every 6 months? Do they come back every 3 months, for example? That type of insight. Or if you're presenting to an array of stakeholders, quite quickly, they understand what you're talking about, and you can start influencing what you're going to do. Otherwise, it's just subjective thought. Maybe we only get 20 customers back, or, you know, and unless you show the data, nobody can really make actionable insights. So things like CRM roles are quite cool like that, because they get to fuse the data with the insight and actually, you know, take action quite quickly. And then, you know, I use email providers. So we have third-party email platforms. So, you know, everybody would know MailChimp, but in e-com businesses, you typically need a bit more power behind your database marketing. And a lot of these companies now have like propensity models where, like, I don't know if you've heard, I'm sure you have, RFM, so recency, frequency, monetary types of algorithms to sort of show, well, where the clusters of customers are and how you can market to them quite quickly.
Mm. No, I actually haven't heard of that. Tell us more, RFM.
I mean, it's a database mining technique. So essentially you scorecard your customers based on how the most frequent, I'm going back with recency. So basically when you last saw them, so yep. You score them from 1 to 5, it's like in quintiles, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And then you look at their frequency. So how often they come and purchase from you or visit you, and then your monetary is, you know, how much they spend with you. So somebody that you've just seen that comes to your website in my context quite a lot and spends a lot of money would have a score of 555. Mm-hmm. Somebody that I've seen a year ago, been to the website once and spent $20 or pounds, you know, would have a score of 111. Mm-hmm. So what you can quickly do in like email platforms, or even you can even do this yourself, is you can market to all the 555 people, and then you can market to all the 111 people. Mm-hmm. And immediately you've used data to see, you can start testing and marketing to each of those scores to mm-hmm. see where you could get a new customer, so a returning customer back, or how much money you can make from them. So bit of a hack definition there, but you know, things like that are quite easy to do with some companies because out of the box, they provide this type of insight. So you don't have to do it yourself.
Yeah, no, that's a really good walkthrough. And so basically you might even market to them differently, right? So if it's a 555 customer, you might send them one message, and a 111 customer, you might send them a different message because, you know, like they're less likely to respond. So it has to be, you know, like maybe a more lucrative deal or a quick sale or something,
yeah.
Very cheap offer. Whereas a 555, yeah. You know, you know that they love your product, they're more likely to buy something that's high end, and you might want to approach them with that type of offer as well.
Yeah, so I mean, it's I'm probably playing more with like database marketing, but it's quite powerful because depending on your resource, right? You only have so much breadth to do this stuff.
Yeah.
But if you've got third party partners and they can make light work of your data,
yeah,
it's very powerful because you can almost predict what your customer's going to do, or a percentage of what your customers are going to do,
mm-hmm.
and know when to market to them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, cool. And this is an interesting topic because I don't think we've, I've discussed with this with anybody on the podcast before. We're getting into like customer segmentation. Let's talk more about that. Like with your CRM background, you'd have a lot of experience in customer segmentation. Like, you know, what is geodemographical segmentation and why do businesses use it?
Yeah, so you've touched on one point. So when people talk about customer segmentation, they do geographically, they do behaviorally. Mm-hmm. You know, there's many ways to cut the data, right? And obviously every business is subjective, mm-hmm. has their own subjective goals. So I wish there was always like this just turnkey way that you could pick up the data and off you go. You sort of don't know what you're playing with until you start asking stakeholders the right question.
Yeah.
But typically, you know, you apply the 80-20 rule, you know, so where am I getting 80% of my customers from?
Mm-hmm.
Where am I getting 20% of my profitability from? Because essentially you want to focus on them otherwise you're just spending too much resource.
You mean 80% of your profitability?
Yeah. So applying the 80-20 rule quickly allows you to take a lot of data and just sort of get into the most actionable data set.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
So customer segmentation, typically I'll look at geographical, so you know what countries we get the revenue from. So for example, Europe, everybody gets so excited about Europe. You know, let's market to German customers, Spanish customers, French customers. But, you know, in some cases, they could be like 10% of your customer base.
Mm-hmm.
And you typically have to translate everything you do in English into those languages as well. And then in countries like Germany, there's a lot of legislation as well on how you communicate to customers. So quite quickly, you could burn a lot of resource going after the wrong customer.
Yeah.
So you got to think about your resource and you know what customer segments you actually want to go for.
Mm-hmm.
Behavioral, we play a lot with, you know, when somebody comes to the website, what do we know about them? So there's a lot of technology out there, which is quite cool, where we can actually learn about whether you're looking at the site on a mobile device
mm-hmm.
or a desktop, and we can actually record your like IP, not IP, sorry, your, I want to say your Mac, but your Mac address. So we can actually start to get a 360 degree view of how you visit our site. Because for example, somebody that looks at an email will look at their email on a mobile device, but then they might purchase on a desktop. And that's quite valuable information. Because
well, why is that valuable information?
Because you know, if you know, for example, that somebody opens an email on a Friday, pardon me, there's a cluster of customers that open an email on a Friday and then they purchase on a Sunday night, you know, that feeling just before you go to work on a Monday. Sunday is
want to spend some money
on all your devices. Yeah. What was that?
You want to spend some money before going to work.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, right? eBay, like, you know, eBay, for example, like their biggest traffic, or one of the biggest traffic surges is that sort of 7 to 10 p.m. part on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Because everybody's like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm relaxing, getting ready for the week. So it's quite valuable to see what cluster of your customers do something on a Friday on a mobile device and then actually purchase on a Sunday night through a desktop.
Yeah.
You know, that behavior, you can actually make quite a lot of action on that. You could send them an email on Sunday afternoon and say, hey, just a reminder, there's a great offer for you, for example. And it and hits their devices on a Sunday night just when they're browsing, just to get them over the line. So, there's a lot of ways that you can play with customer segmentation, but the more people looking at it in your team will help. Sometimes it can just be yourself, so you can you got to test. You sort of got to try this agile methodology where you sort of go, you know, test, get some insight, test it, see if anything happens. And then if it doesn't, great, come back, do it again, find something else to test and be quite systematic about it.
Gotcha. And this is very interesting because it raises the question of ethics. Like, is it ethical to, you know, take advantage of people's habits and send them on a Sunday night a reminder and get them to spend money? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a gray area, right? It's a gray area, especially in Europe. So, you know, obviously when you go to a transactional website, you'll see things like cookies, right? So you see that box that comes up on the header or the footer. So yeah, we have cookies on our site. We want to learn a bit about you. And so a lot of what I've just spoken about is usually encapsulated within the cookie policy or the privacy policy. You might have heard about GDPR coming up as well. You heard about that?
No, it was GDPR.
Oh God, I can't remember what I'm saying. It's basically data protection. It's a big legislation coming in Europe next April.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
And basically businesses are going to have to declare all the data they capture.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be such a pain for businesses. Like,
it's a big step because what you've just described is, you know, ethically businesses are going to have to be very open. Well, they have to about how they're storing customer data, what they're storing and how they transfer that data. And I mean, it's a good move. It can, with what I do, it can get a bit big brother at times, but you know, there's nothing bad about it. But some customers, you know, you would have shopped before and then 20 minutes later you're on Facebook and then you see this ad pop up on your feed saying, hey, Kirill, buy this now. And you're like, hang on, I was just on this website. How does it know? You know, things like that, that retargeting is a big part of e-commerce. And, you know, it's all encapsulated in a cookie privacy policy. And I think it's just going to be more legislated as we go on because people don't want to be followed all the time.
Yeah, that's true. But also we got to, like, the way I normally answer that question is that it can be seen as evil, as unethical, but at the same time, it can also be seen as helpful. It can be seen as we're helping people not to forget to buy what they wanted to buy. We're helping people to understand, like, better see insights into their own preferences that they might not be aware of. But because we've seen many people like them who are interested in certain products, which they're interested in, then they also bought this. So that's why we're recommending this to them. And
yeah,
and that kind of like stems into what you mentioned, that people don't like being followed around. But the question is, who doesn't like to be following around? Is it like the baby boomers, our generation, or the millennials? Like, it's completely different stories. The millennials, they don't care. Like, most people of my brother's age, who are like 20 years or younger, they happily trade their information about themselves for improved products and services. That's the world they've grown up in. That's the world they live in. And so, you know, a lot of this legislation is still targeted towards our generation or older generation, but the new generation that's coming, they're not really going to care that much about it. That's why, by the way, the cookie thing is going to be deprecated starting 2018. I think January or February, like early 2018, is going to be like removed. Websites won't have to do that pop-up box anymore because it's just annoying more than anything.
Well, I, from memory, Google's already, you know, they're going to have like cookie-less ways of tracking you. I think Google already know, to be fair. I quite like Google Analytics and I use their premium package quite a bit as well. And the stuff you can do on that is just amazing. But it's all legit because they basically hash you as a person.
Yeah.
And but under that hash code, they know your mobile device, your desktop. I mean, Google know a lot of it and absolutely you bang on. People, well, organizations like Google will know quite quickly who you are, even though you don't think they know who you are. I can guarantee you they definitely know how you travel through the internet and what sites you go on.
I just
don't know if you can ever have a silver bullet approach to confirm to your customer that, you know, we're actually just trying to send you meaningful prompts and not trying to stalk you.
No, that's an interesting one. And there's a whole concept now of a digital avatar that as you browse through the internet and you do stuff and you buy things, because these websites like Google and you know, eBay or other websites, they collect information about you, slowly there's like an avatar that's been built for you. Like in the movie Avatar, there's like this creature that you know, blah, blah, blah. This is like a digital avatar, like a digital representation of yourself, which is linked to your address, to your phone number, to everything that they know about you, plus all your preferences, plus everything. So basically, the more you interact with online stuff and e-commerce specifically, the more this avatar is enriched with information about you. And at some point, they could just recreate you in, you know, let's say hypothetically, in an artificial intelligence. And based on the behavior of that avatar, they can predict your behavior and therefore interact with you even before you have, you know, some desires or thoughts. They will know that you will have them, like literally a day in advance or something like that. That's like the extreme.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where it's all going.
I tell you, I mean, this is it's old now, right? But have you ever heard of the zero moment of truth?
No, I don't think so. Tell us, what is that?
It's like Google commissioned this study. It was back in like 2012, but it was like one of those turning points for me. It's basically that moment where the point in the buying cycle when, you know, you're researching a product. But what gets you over the line? What makes you purchase that product? Mm-hmm. It's that moment where your brain goes, "Yeah, I'm going to buy it." Mm-hmm. And they did this study, and I really recommend having a look at it because, I mean, again, it's old, but it's really interesting. And there's quite a few videos on it. Is, you know, what influences you to purchase? And so you're talking like this. It's a lot like that. What behaviors mean that you will go and do something? You know, how do you know when you're going to buy a car? Is it lots and lots of research, and then you say to me, "Hey, Nick, buy that car," and I go, "Yeah, you know what? I'm going to do it now because I've researched enough." You know, why are you so influential in me doing that? And maybe the zero moment—it's called ZMOT. Maybe it's just not as relevant now because what you've just said is exactly. People just know so much they don't need to think about it because they've got the data to support the behavior, and so they can just augment that quite quickly and you know, channel what they need to channel to the customer.
Yeah, no, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, this is what we're going into.
Slightly off-piste, but yeah, it's very interesting playing, you know, this data science concept, because I definitely eat it up, but I won't lie. It's if you don't have that background, it's quite hard to sort of latch onto that stream of tech or skill that you want to learn to see, you know, whether you can actually make something of it. So I'm definitely here coming from a very different end of the spectrum in land of data science, because everything that I've learned so far has always been far more of an analyst type of base. So we'll see what happens.
But it's interesting because the CRM space and the work that you're doing, dealing with like behavioral aspects, that's a huge part of data science. You know, like it can be attributed to analytics and, you know, being an analyst and so on. But that is like behavioral aspects and psychology and things like that. That is like a gold mine. It's always going to be required because people are always going to be there, and you're going to need to analyze it, whether it's in a selling kind of like CRM type of role, or it might be in medicine, it might be in somewhere else where people mass behaviors, mass psychology needs to be analyzed through machine learning and other techniques in order to come up with actionable insights. So it's a great space to get into the field of data science.
Yeah. And it's obviously so subjective to the business you work for and the client. And that's why, like, I really employ what you do, because it's, you tell people how to go on these journeys. And I'm an example of that person that's gone, oh, hey, I understand this. Now I want to go on this journey. Mm-hmm. And it'd be great to do that in the CRM space, but it's so subjective to the business that you work for, because every customer is different. Every business segments their customers in a different way.
But
typically they'll be male or female and they do something. So
there's always age, location,
things. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the successes I've had is distilling all of this insight into like a one page infographic on your customer. Mm-hmm. Because people that don't understand data, you show them something like an infographic and within seconds they understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's good to sort of pat yourself on the back and say, hey, people actually understand the data a lot more now through these just infographic icons. So it's quite cool.
Yeah. No, that's a good approach. Do you have any more examples? That was a really cool Friday, Sunday example. I've got another one. Like, I got another one myself. And then I'd like to see here, maybe you have some other segmentation or behavioral examples that, you know, maybe can be useful to someone working in the space of CRM. One that I know is that retail sales in February, they always drop off. Like, you always have like a dip in February. And that was so interesting to see, like, because I like in the advanced Tableau course, I think we do some analysis of that. And we look at the retail sector of Australia for, you know, different types of products, like all types of products in the retail sector. And they always drop off in every single sector. It's crazy. And the reason for that is because of the Christmas sales, because people buy a lot of stuff for Christmas, for presents. But then you'd think, okay, so they bought stuff in Christmas in December. You'd think it drop off in January, right? But no, it drops off in February, because the credit card payoff days are usually, you know, 30 to 60 days or whatever. And so it times in such a way that in January, they still don't feel the shock of the Christmas purchases that they made, and then they get the credit card statement, and then like in February, okay, you know, time to slow down the sales. So that's an interesting one always.
Yeah, and that's, so you've touched on what I would define as seasonality.
Yeah.
Or one of the many parallel streams of seasonality, because and that's such a great example. And, you know, another reason for that is people typically get paid in advance before Christmas.
Mm.
And so they don't get paid again until potentially late January.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be on a shoestring budget, and then they get, you know, their credit card bill, and like there's this whopping payment where their January pay gets actually funneled into their February credit card statement. And you know, so, you know, that's one probably a very big factor as to why things drop off in February. But in the retail space, especially in the Western world, I obviously can't speak too closely on the Eastern world, but I know in the Western world, things like we see the same thing when you come up to Black Friday, if you know Black Friday.
Yep, end of November.
You know, it's massive. When I came over here, it wasn't really a big thing in the UK. And then, oh God, I'd say about 5 years ago, it just ramped up. People thought, yeah, we can make a lot of money here before Christmas kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually have this like 8-week trading period where a lot of companies try and just funnel all this stock to their customers as quickly as they can to sort of close off the year as profitably as possible. And so we do, in the last couple of years in the various companies I've worked for, we do a lot of work in that September, October time to help get customers knowledgeable about our business. Because once Black Friday hits, your inbox, I actually employ anybody listening to hop into their inbox and look at Black Friday. And you will see that, you know, every single company you have interacted with was probably sent you an email on that day.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you get through that clutter? Mm-hmm. How do you get through that clutter? And we spend a lot of time doing like nurturing campaigns with our customers. So, you know, people that are on our email database and they like to hear from us, we start to send them communication in the lead up to big things like Black Friday to say, hey, you know, there's going to be a special deal for you. You know, come back here, we'll send you this, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to think about what your customer will probably get from all your competitors as you hit these key months. And again, the way you do that is you look at, you know, all your sales spikes in the year, and you start to sort of create these seasonality trends and start to work towards campaigns to yield to those trends, to hopefully see that they happen again. Mm-hmm. And if not, you just recalibrate what you're going to do and still keep it going, but you need to have a bit of flex in what you do in when you look at seasonality, because it's not always year for year the same, but it's pretty close. Mm-hmm. We see, like in the UK, we see that drop off in February as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've been marketing and advertising to people for 8 weeks. You've got Black Friday, then you've got Christmas, then you've got an end of season sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've probably taken all the money you can, right?
Yeah.
In a way, I'm contradicting myself. It's not an exact science, but you can get pretty darn close to making sure you know what your customer is going to do in what month. Mm-hmm. If you've got sort of like good clustering techniques on where you get your money from.
Yeah, gotcha. And what kind of like, what size of databases have you worked with recently? Is it like thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers?
Yeah, I've gone from 500,000 to about 2 million customers. Wow. So in some cases, that's not very big if you're in bank, for example, mm-hmm. but in the retail space, it's a good number mm-hmm. to play with, because you've got lots of different segments within that database.
Yeah.
Typically, you'll have a big portion that you don't hear anything from. So that's a great opportunity to reactivate them and say, oh, you know, hey, Kirill, remember us. Mm-hmm. Here's 20 quid off. Come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Things like that are quite powerful.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. Transactional data. That's what I wanted to talk about. There's two types of data in geodemographic segmentation, from my experience. There's static data, like, you know, what's their gender, what's their age, which changes, but slowly, what's their income, what's their affluence, like how much money do they have? Generally, like those things are pretty static. They change, you know, like even if you record them every month, they're not going to change that much over the course of a year. But at the same time, there's also transactional data. There's data that, you know, they swipe their credit card, or like if you're a bank, you have, you know, they swipe in their credit card. But if you're not a bank, you're like a store, you can track, you know, what have they purchased? Not only what have they purchased, which pages on your website have they been to? Like you say, have they used their mobile or their desktop or laptop or whatever? What browser do they use? What time of day do they do? So data that is updated frequently, like on a daily basis or even more frequently.
Yeah.
From your experience, the difference between the two, the value that each one of those types of data brings into your analytics, into your segmentations.
Yeah. So the most valuable part is the way customers pay. So do they pay with a Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or PayPal, for example? Mm-hmm. In Europe, it's massive that you understand this, because in Europe, there's different payment methods that people prefer mm-hmm. that aren't typical in the UK. So if you want to go to Germany, for example, you need to employ a different payment gateway, because the German customer likes to transact in a particular way. And if you don't know that, you're missing out. So my experience, I look at the payment method more within transactional data. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you do in the fashion space is you actually look at the title, so Mr. Mrs. and whatnot, because you can find some people, males use their female's credit card, their other half, so if it's a female, and they actually use each other's credit card, but the delivery address is different from the card holder address.
Mm-hmm. And so what is that? What insight does that give you?
Some people can pay with their other half's card at time.
And so what action do you take on that? Like, how is that insight useful?
Logical question, you know, so what?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the question you always need to ask yourself. Oh, that's interesting. So what?
Yeah.
I would say it's probably more of a just a nice to know that if our returning customer, our loyal customer, elicits that behavior, it proves typically potentially what is maybe a geographical trend that we see. So maybe in a more affluent part there, you know, that behavior is more prominent mm-hmm. than in a less affluent part of the country. I wouldn't say it's too actionable. It just helps support, you know, who is the customer and
okay,
how to transact. Things like PayPal are big kickers, because they're usually you have to put a bit more development into your website for things like PayPal to make it a seamless experience, because you have to hop off the website, mm-hmm. go to PayPal, come back to the website. But it's such an easy way of transacting, because you just one login and off you go. You don't have to type in any credit card data. And we see a rising increase in things like PayPal. So you need to think about, okay, how can we make the customer checkout experience a lot more fluid using things like PayPal? So they're the two areas that I've played with in transactional data. Mm-hmm. Other than that, yeah, because it's e-commerce is a global thing, right? So you want to look at where you're getting all your transactions from, and you know, sometimes you have to put currency buffers in, and does that make you more expensive, for example? Mm-hmm. But that's probably the arena that I've played with in transactional data.
Okay, interesting. And I'll probably add a bit to that. When I was in SunSuper, like a pension fund
in Australia,
it was interesting because we had access to a lot of, like any pension fund, not specifically SunSuper, but the difference between a superannuation fund or pension fund and a bank is that superannuation fund has access to static data mostly, the gender and so on, and the location and affluent. Whereas a bank has access to all that data plus transactional data. They have the advantage. Like in my view, it's a huge advantage that you have information on what your customers are purchasing all the time. You can build a much more accurate avatar for your customers. And yeah, I was working with a consultant, senior data science consultant from overseas. And when he came and was helping out with some projects, he saw that we don't have the transactional data. And it was like a revelation for him that without transactional data, the accuracy of the models drops like by 30%, something like ridiculous. That because you have, when you have transactional data, it's constantly changing, or it's like constantly being updated, and you have information like on a daily basis about people's purchasing preferences and so on, you can understand what type of person they are, segment and cluster your customer base much more accurately, about 30% more accurately than when you don't have transactional data. So yeah, that was a very interesting insight for me.
One of the things I did forget to mention is we looked a lot about what our new customer purchased. Mm-hmm. And typically they would purchase a particular shoe type, for example, versus returning customers. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting because then you can funnel all your marketing efforts to actually promote that. Mm-hmm. That one product, because typically you've got the data, the transactional data, to prove that there's one product that's preferred by first time customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's the same with any business, I'm sure, whether you're selling products or services, there'll always be one to three products that are purchased more than others.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that they are just watertight and they're fantastic. So you always have that steady flow of customers purchasing them. Mm.
So that's, again, your 80-20 rule, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know your direct experience with e-com teams, but typically you're wearing many hats. Mm. You're not just brought in as a subject matter expert for what you do, whether it's SEO or paid search or social. You have to be quite commercial, and you have to understand the full customer journey and how you influence that with what you do. Mm-hmm. So this is why employing, data science and methodology into how you work is just so advantageous, because you're not just doing one thing each day. You're trading a business, and you need to be quite fluid in your influence. Mm-hmm. And so that's why data is in my subjective opinion again, but you really need to understand what the data is telling you and how you can make insight on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally. I had another question for you. A/B testing. Do you do much of that in e-commerce?
Yeah, a lot, a lot. Again, it depends on how many humans you've got in the team to help you do it, because it can be, it takes time.
Yeah.
It takes time. So typically what we play with each week is doing things like email subject lines, because that's the first thing that you see in an email. Mm-hmm. You know, the big, big thing everybody loves is emojis. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit 50-50 on them, but... again, do that Black Friday thing. Have a look at Black Friday, and I guarantee you'll see so many emojis in your inbox. Mm-hmm. You know, we A/B test that, but then we also A/B test how people come to the website. So if we know that Kirill is a very profitable customer,
mm-hmm. which Kirill is not, Kirill doesn't do stuff.
you're throwing me there. If you come to the site, I might show you a particular message versus a new customer that I've never seen before, and just test that engagement. So maybe you've come to the website 5 times, which shows that you're ready to purchase or you're considering purchasing. So maybe I could have a pop-up that comes up or some type of activation to prompt you to say, hey, if you check out now, here's some incentive, or why don't you have a look at this? And, you know, there's a lot of technology that you can do that's quite easy to A-B test how your customers, whether they're transacting customers or just browsing customers, mm-hmm. interact with your site. But it, yeah, again, you need to think about it. You need to think about the customer journey and what you're actually trying to prove. Because mm-hmm. typically with A-B testing, people can get quite excited and you can have like 100 tests. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have a big team, you don't have that cadence to do those 100 tests. So you have to be quite picky about what you test.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so can you tell us like the technicalities of the A-B test? Like what if somebody wants to run an A-B test, let's say they have a small team, like a small yeah. customer base, what are some of the steps that they need to take in an A-B test, and what are like the most important things to look out for, like some pitfalls that you might help people avoid?
Yeah, so typically you're trying to ask the customer, you're trying to define what the customer is trying to do. You know, what are you helping them solve? Mm-hmm. And that's largely how we've always done A-B testing. So you've got to think about, well, what are they doing now, and what do we think we want them to do based on data? Mm-hmm. What do we think we should influence them in doing? Depending on the stakeholder group, you need to think about how people can sometimes influence the wrong type of test. So you need to be quite specific about what you're trying to test. And you're not testing an array of things. You're testing, you know, do our customers resonate more with a blue button versus a green button? Mm-hmm. And that's essentially a test. It's not lots of different messaging. So people can get pretty hyped up. And some of the pitfalls I've seen is if you get the wrong stakeholder group in there, they can say, oh, you know, let's just test everything. And it's all very broad and it's not specific enough, and people aren't thinking about what you're actually trying to get help the customer do. And there's a big thing around business goals mm-hmm. and customer goals. So people typically always talk about business goals. We want to make money, but customer goals are, what are you actually trying? You know, I'm a customer. I'm on your website for a reason. How are you going to help me do that? So if you start thinking like that, it's quite a challenging exercise to think about business goals and customer goals.
Yep.
But it helps things like A-B testing quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's called I worked with a UX designer. So we're sort of in a bit of a UX part of the discussion now. And that's user experience. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with quite a few consultants, and they talk like this because they need businesses to understand what their customers are doing and what we're trying to do through A-B testing. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting journey, but you've got to think about, I keep repeating myself, but you got to think about what the customer's doing, what you want them to do, but where are the pitfalls? So typically a lot of A-B testing that we play with is in the conversion path, mm-hmm. getting people to transact. There's usually some blocker there. Maybe Kirill, you come to the website and you want to transact, but then I present you with this very long form of about 30 different fields. Mm-hmm. Typically, as a new customer, you're not going to fill out all of this information because you've never transacted with me before. So maybe all I need to give you is just tell me your email address,
yeah,
and your payment details, and off you go. So that's quite a good test to play with, but it's quite a massive one because it's part of the checkout. So at the end of the day, it all rolls up is what do you want the customer to do? Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, people will just in your business will just say, "Oh, let's test this," and you're like, well, "Why do you want to test that? Mm-hmm. What are we helping the customer achieve by testing that?" Mm-hmm. So yeah,
no, that's cool. It was very interesting what you mentioned about business goals versus customer goals. Do you have an example of when you have, or you would have, or a company should forego a business goal and sacrifice a business goal in order to help a customer instead?
Ooh, you know,
maybe something interesting.
Controversial question.
I know. Yeah,
controversial question. Oh God, I don't have enough experience yet in this because I'll always say business goals supersede customer goals, which is horrible for me to say, but it's very hard for e-commerce businesses to drop mm-hmm. the speed that they make money to yeah. yield towards customer goals
yeah.
for a longer term gain.
Yeah,
it's very hard. In e-commerce, it's very hard. I think in bricks and mortar sort of offline businesses, it might be a bit easier because it takes a bit longer. Mm-hmm. But e-commerce roles can be quite, you know, you've got these budgets you've got to hit yeah. every week. So it can be like quite.
Yeah.
But, you know, an example of what we did was we come into the summer season, right? Mm-hmm. and I want to buy a pair of, well, in Australia, we call them thongs, of course.
you want to buy yourself some thongs?
In the States, we call them, you know, flip-flops. Essentially, as you come in, sort of 2-3 months before a holiday period, people start coming to footwear sites to have a look about, look at what seasonal footwear there is, right?
Yeah.
So a customer goal is, I need a pair of shoes for my holiday.
Mm-hmm.
That is fashionable and open-toed. Mm-hmm. But a business goal is, we've got to make this amount of money in this week. So they're very different goals, right?
Yeah.
And so your question's very valid, but it's very hard to not weight everything towards a business goal. But you need to be very mindful of the customer goal, because a customer goal, if you fulfill that, what you would actually do is create a lot of content to help that customer fulfill that journey. So you tell them about the shoes, you show them what new shoes are there, how it can benefit them, feature benefit. And then you would hope that the business goal is fulfilled, mm-hmm. because you've done that work to take them along the journey to then purchase what mm-hmm. is their holiday shoe. Mm-hmm. So the two eventually connect, but depending on the e-commerce business and the maturity of that business and how customer-centric they are, I've always seen it to weight a bit more towards business goals. But get a UX consultant into your business and they can actually help you transform quite quickly the way you think about a customer,
because
mm-hmm. that's their job.
Yeah.
It's to make the customer experience a lot more mm-hmm. Fluid and beneficial for your business.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard of this company in the US? It's a shoe company, so you might have heard of it. They really made a huge name for themselves for the customer experience that they were creating. And you know, people would call them up, and there was like even one case when the support rep was on the phone with a customer for like 10 hours in a row, helping them pick out the right shoes. And it's a big company.
Zappos.
You know that story? Like that, I think that's the only example that comes to mind of when they put the customer experience ahead of the business goal. Yeah. Like it's no good for any company to have a customer support rep sitting on the phone with one customer for 10 hours, right? That's a lot of cost.
Exactly.
But they do that, and they built a name for themselves, and now people know if they go to Zappos, they will, you know, they'll guarantee they'll find the right size, find the right shoe, find the best shoe that they want. Everything will be, and you know, they sacrificed a bit of business revenue and so on to build this brand, to build the customer experience, and now everybody refers them to their friends to Zappos.
Yeah, if you were ever in Vegas, I did the tour, so you can do a tour of the Zappos business. It takes about, I think, 2 hours or so.
You did that?
Yeah, and it was amazing. I was there with my wife and she's like, you need to calm down. You're a bit excited, because I was like...
because it's a shoe business, right?
It's it's a much bigger, but their methodology, like, you know, in the UK, we can be a bit cynical at times, but the American way of customer service is just so fantastic, right? You know, they've got like these commandments and all their desks are themed, and then you hear about that story that you just spoke about, and you just like, people like me just eat it up, because I'm like, this is fantastic. You know, these guys are so customer centric that every single thought starts from the customer and then they work up.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in many other businesses, if you're small, it's about, you know, money, let's generate it. But Zappos, their culture is completely fueled by the customer. Mm-hmm. And all businesses are, but these guys brag about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's books about it, and it's such a cool company to go to, because you want to come back from a tour like that and say, hey, let's employ some of these methodologies in our business. But then you've got a huge cultural journey then.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically asking the business to yield to how you're thinking about the customer. And it's CRM roles, I think, should be very closely aligned to UA, you know, UX designers and data analysts, because the three of you can actually, or three departments can actually start influencing a business to be far more customer centric, mm-hmm. and think like Zappos as well. But you know, they're extreme cases, but it's interesting that you talk like that, because there's not many companies that can talk like this, where they've had staff on the phone for hours on end.
Yeah.
I think they get customers just calling in for a chat. You know, but if that customer comes back and buys maybe 4 or 5 things from them, you know,
yeah,
expand that out by, you know, another 100,000 customers. Well, there you go. You've got a new customer base.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've got to figure out what works, but it's, if you're in Vegas, go have a look, because it's really interesting. They actually have like full tour guides and, you know, taking you through the business. Yeah. So it's quite cool.
You're a very interesting guy, Nick. Like, out of all the things you could do in Vegas, you go for a Zappos facility tour. Like,
yeah, yeah. If who says that? Go to Vegas and gamble. Go to a tour.
Yeah, no, okay. No, fair enough. Yeah, better than going and gambling your money away.
I did go gambling just for the
of course.
Probably should have said that first, hey?
Of course you did. And then when you lost all your money, you were so devastated. You're like, I've got to go have some fun in the Zappos tour.
Yeah, I'll just spend $20 and go on a Zappos tour and, you know, drown my sorrows and walk around a building for 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, gotcha. All right, mate, we're coming like to an end. It's been a pretty cool session. I just have one question left for you. The book, like, do you have a book in mind you can recommend to our listeners to, you know, for them to get better at CRM stuff, data science, or something that can help them better themselves?
Yeah, I haven't found the Holy Grail book, but the one that I refer to the most is Cole. I can never pronounce her last name, but I know a lot of people that you've spoken to mention her. Cole's Storytelling with Data book.
Yeah.
I use that a lot because it's a great way to distill how you think you're analyzing data and actually how you should present it. Mm-hmm. So I use that book a lot as a reference tool. I'm going to put one more in there. There's one called Resonate by Nancy Durant. I think it is. What's her name again? Duarte. I think it's Nancy Duarte. And so there's people out there that do these great storytelling books with data, but yeah. Cole's is probably what I use the most. Yeah. So I'd highly recommend anybody getting that.
Yeah.
If you're in this world where you need to distill a lot of data insight into an infographic or a presentation quickly, it's a bit of a holy grail.
That's pretty cool. I've actually got a book, I think, myself here. One of the guests on the podcast recommended it, and I thought, you know, you might be interested in because you're interested in visualization. It's called Dear Data.
Never heard of it. I'll get
It's like these two ladies, one in the UK and one in, I think, US. They were kind of like, for a year, they were sending each other postcards, but instead of writing text on the postcards, in each postcard, they would like describe their week. So once per week, they were sending it. Describe their week with charts. So check that out.
Oh,
so
that's wow.
So what they did in that week, what the other one did in that week. And
that's hard, man.
You know, like they were like hand-drawn charts on these postcards. And so here you have all of these 52 charts for each one of them. Very interesting, like gives you some cool ideas for data visualization and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, you just open it up and you're just reading somebody's postcards. Like once an evening, you check out a postcard and so on. I haven't read many myself, but yeah, I've read a couple and they're interesting. Like going through, like, because for instance, they might describe like an hour clock and each hour they have like something, like a little symbol represents this is what they were feeling or this is what they were doing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's the hardest skill, but the most fulfilling when you can tell a story with data. And as you probably can tell, I can talk.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you just need the visualization to do the talking for you, right? Yeah. And so that's why I'm putting a lot more time into it, because in one room, you can bring a CFO, the cleaner, and your boss and tell them the same story quite quickly. So it's quite cool.
Yeah, gotcha. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Nick, for coming on the show. Where can our listeners contact you or get in touch, you know, and find out more about your career and journey? What's the best way?
Yeah, I'd hop onto LinkedIn. Nick.pape on LinkedIn, and you'll see my profile there. I got a presentation on CRM that I've put up there as well.
It has 20 views.
Quick nudge.
Yeah. And, by the way, easy way to remember the Nick Pape is like Nick Paper, but without the R on it. That's how you taught me. I can't get out of my head, man. It's like just Pape.
You're not supposed to remember that part, mate. Do you know, I've done that, yeah. To you, it's fine, right?
Yeah.
But I'm never going to use that technique again because people laugh too much.
Well, now, you know, a couple of maybe 100 people, maybe 1,000 people are going to hear it.
So. 100,000.
You're going to be in their heads as well.
Oh, so you're paper without the R, right?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. All right.
Okay, buddy.
Thanks a lot for coming on. This has been a pleasure. Great chat today about the CRM. So.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
All right, there you have it. That was Nick Pape, digital e-commerce specialist. Hope you enjoyed today's episode and learned quite a few things. My personal favorite from this episode was probably the whole concept of how Nick is learning data science to maybe move into data science, but also maybe stay in e-commerce, but borrow those most powerful concepts that he'll take. I think it's a very interesting strategy, because like maybe there are people listening to this podcast who are happy with their roles, who are happy doing what they're doing and don't necessarily want to become data scientists, but they do recognize the power of data. So if you're one of those people, then like Nick, you can just learn data science to borrow those most powerful concepts to enhance your career. A very interesting strategy, and I totally see why that could be the case. And make sure to connect with Nick. You can find his LinkedIn, a URL to his LinkedIn profile, and all the resources for this episode at www.superdatascience.com/97. And by the way, of course, the video for this session is there as well. And on that note, thanks so much for being here today. I look forward to seeing you next time. And until then, happy analyzing.